You're listening to KDNK's Public Affairs Program for Land's Sake. I'm Bill Kite, your host, and today we're lucky to have someone in the studio that knows a lot about open space, Dale Will. Welcome, Dale.
Hello, Bill. Good to be here.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. People don't know what you do for a living.
Well, I negotiate land preservation deals for Pitkin County Open Space and Trails.
And that's so when a new opportunity comes along, you're the person, the point person that tries to make that happen.
Most of the time.
But you have a team of other people that help you, of course.
Yeah, we have a great department, and I can't take credit for everything that we do, but I'm kind of the lead guy. I was hired as their executive director at a time when it was just me and a secretary, and over the years we've accumulated so much land that we had to hire rangers and land planners, and pretty soon it was a staff management position, and I turned it over to someone that knows how to do that and just went back to what I was originally hired to do. I've been at it now for, gosh, for what, 26 years, I guess.
Yeah, that's a lot of places don't realize they try to mold people into what they need in a position or skills that they need instead of letting that person's skills develop and use them that way and not just trying to force a square peg in a round hole. So that's good that you had that opportunity.
Yeah, I remember the county manager at the time said, you know, you've been supervising this guy, and now you want him to be above you in the chain of command. He goes, that only works one in a million times. And then he looked at both of us sitting there smiling at him and said, well, I guess this is the one in a million. So Gary Tenenbaum took over the ED spot, and we're great colleagues and great friends.
Yeah, I like Gary. I'm glad he's in that position. This is a disclaimer. Dale and I are friends, and we have connections that go deep.
Indeed we do.
And one of those is, and I'm just going to say it because we're going to probably get personal here and have some heart-to-heart talking about the land and ourselves. And he and I belong to an exclusive club that we've never asked to join, and that is we both have lost a child, a daughter. And that and other things have bonded us together pretty much pretty strongly as a friend. So I had to do that disclaimer so people know
there
what's
we go.
Going on.
Well, right. Bill knows things about me that hardly anyone knows, and most people wouldn't understand even if I told them.
Well, that's what, you know, friends are about, is trying to understand each other and help. You need help.
So, yep.
So, let's define open space before we go any further.
Sure. Well, I mean, there's definitions of wilderness floating around there, you know, land untrammeled by man. I guess open space is a little bit more generic idea than that. It's basically land that isn't full of human-made stuff.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah, because in wilderness, native peoples were basically run out of the wilderness once it was made wilderness because of that, probably that phrase, you know.
Well, and there is a very kind of anti-humanistic element to environmentalism that I don't enjoy too much, and I've been a bit of a lightning rod in situations where I argue for public access to places that other people are thinking maybe they want to keep, that what they'll tell you is they want to keep it for the wild things, but they include themselves in that. So I'm a big believer that humans belong on these landscapes, and that if we approach them with the right respect, that we can integrate into them just the same way that an elk or a deer or anything else can.
So a lot of the open space that you've dealt with has had human occupation on it, and does some of it still have features that could be used as?
Sure. The program that I work for, Pitkin County Open Space, we seek to protect basically four things. Wildlife habitat, scenery, agriculture, and recreation. So the kinds of things you're going to find on our open space ground will fall into one or more of those categories. But something like an irrigated pasture it's no longer full of its native vegetation, but it's nonetheless, it's part of an ecosystem that supports human beings and part of the hydrological system. So we look at that as open space. Some of our open space is pristine natural habitat that still has all of its original native plants and animals, not the original humans, as you pointed out, but that's another subject.
For sure, yeah. It's a way for people to preserve land, basically, isn't it? When you go in and buy a place for open space, what is the latest that you could talk about that worked really well?
We just bought the 4,300 acres up on the top of Cottonwood Pass called the Three Meadows Ranch. And that was an interesting project because it's in Eagle County. I work for Pitkin County. I live in Garfield County. But we were able to get Eagle County and Aston Valley Land Trust through a donation from the Wexner family. And by the way, this last weekend, we lost Gideon Kaufman, wrecked his bicycle up on Castle Creek. But he was in the mix of all the people that brought funding together, and we were able to purchase that 4,300 acres. And the basic idea of open space preservation is you're using your purchasing power to protect things. The Nature Conservancy was one of the original pioneers of the idea that if you really want to protect something forever, you do it the old-fashioned way, you just buy it. For years, environmentalists have tried to protect land through regulation, through zoning, and things like the Endangered Species Act. And as my old friend Dave Brower used to like to say, when you do it that way, you have to win every battle and you can't lose a single one. Whereas if you can find the wherewithal to buy these places, then you've protected them, hopefully forever.
And that's something that the protections are legal. Is that correct?
Correct. If there's one thing that Americans believe in, it's property rights. There's great debates about exactly what they include and what they should include, but there is uniform agreement that if you buy something in a voluntary agreement, it's yours. And if your organization like ours or like the Land Trust is set up to protect things forever, then that's the way that's going to be.
Okay. Because what incentive do people have to try to get their land bought by open space?
Well, we can compete head-to-head with private developers. And one of the great things about working with us is that if there's a problem with developing a piece of property, it might have a difficult access, or it might be far away from utilities, or it might be in a jurisdiction that makes it difficult for people to get permits. We don't care about any of that. And so often we're able to come to the table, and many of these old ranching families in the valley, if they want to work with us, they don't ever list their property for sale. So there again, they're not paying a real estate commission. And then, I pride myself on being able to figure out a way to meet the need of the private owner that's ready to sell something and make them whole in a way where their net bottom line is as good as if they were selling to some developer. And yet we also try to do it for the least possible cost to the public. So that in a nutshell is what I do.
All right. What are some of the threats to open space at this time in our lives?
Open space that's already been protected is what you're talking about?
Yeah.
Well, I'd have to say climate change is probably the top of that list. We can protect all the land you want in a local area, but with what's going on with global temperatures and hydrological implications, it's not going to be enough if the climate becomes inhospitable. So I'd have to say that's at the top of the list.
Climate change. I didn't even think of that as a threat to open space at all. That's interesting. We'll have to talk some more about that over a beer.
Okay. Yeah, well, we can change our attitude with a little beer when we get done chatting for sure.
That's true. What you have a way of working with people to get across what your point of view is and helping them to decide what they want to do. What's your secret?
I listen. Some of these relationships take years to evolve. One of my favorite people in the whole valley is Billy Grange, and he grew up on that ranch right outside of Basalt, and he's still there ranching. Well, I went to talk to him in about the year 2000 or so, and did my song and dance routine like a door-to-door salesman almost. You know, here's what a conservation easement is, and we can buy them, and you can keep the land, but you can get paid for your development rights, and then you don't ever have to worry about developing the land, and you can put that money you make on the conservation easement back into running the ranch, and so on and so forth. And he sat there silently, quietly taking all this in, and said, "Thank me for coming out." And I left, and I heard absolutely nothing from him for 5 years.
Wow.
And I would check in with him every year or something, and he, okay, I'll let you know, kind of thing. And one day he called me up, and he's like, "Dale, this is Billy Grange. You still want to buy a conservation easement on my place?" And he was agitated. And
wow, what happened?
I said, "Well, sure, Billy, and we'll get to work on it." And these projects don't happen instantly, and the ranch conservation easements are some of the most complicated ones, because they're keeping the land, and we will leave them with a couple of development rights, one for each of their primary family members, is typical. It takes a while to put this stuff together. And that was another one that involved the town of Basalt and GOCO and Pitkin County. GOCO's the Great Outdoor Colorado Trust Fund that we get help from the state. So anyway, we got to work on it, and we made it happen. And he came out happy. He got a payment of $5 million for that easement. And what did he do with it? He went off to Debeck and bought a ranch that was already conserved that he got a deal on because it was had no more development rights, so that he could diversify his land base. And he'll raise cattle in Debeck and move them back and forth between there and here. Well, to answer your question, I found out years later what agitated him so much to call me up was two things were happening simultaneously. Number one, there was a developer who literally, this is almost sounds like something from a movie, but he was coming in and out of the ranch in a limousine and knocking on the door and offering Billy this great amount of money. Because the ranch is, people that would know Basalt know this, it's right on the edge of Basalt, right behind the mini storage units and where Big O Tire is. And so that was going on, and he was getting tired of that. But then his best friend was a man named Stanley Nadel. And Stanley owned a ranch up in Woody Creek. They were all descendants from these Italians from the Aosta region in the Alps. But Stanley had sold his ranch, big, nice, big amount of money, and moved over to River Valley Ranch into this nice home on a golf course community. And a year later, Stanley was so sad he didn't have his land anymore and went out and killed himself.
Oh, no.
And when that happened, Billy just, that was it. He's like, "This is not what's going to happen to me. I'm going to conserve this place forever, and I'm going to live here for the rest of my life."
Yep.
And all of these developers can, you know, take a long walk on a short dock. I'm not going to talk to them.
Right. So, well, that's amazing.
But that was 5 years that went into that one. There's many other examples of relationships with people that they just take a while to build. And these properties are their most valuable asset. They've often inherited from generations of stewardship. They're slow to make decisions. They're nervous about working with the government. They're nervous about giving up their property rights or decreasing their property rights. So, you know, I don't try to rush anyone. It's all just careful communication and listening to what they care about. And often they become great friends because what I get to enjoy is their love of their land.
Right, exactly. You're listening to KDNK's Public Affairs Program for Land's Sake. Today our guest is Dale Will, and I'm Bill Kite, your host. We're talking about land and issues of rights of land for people that want to put conservation easements on to keep that land free from development, the wrong kind of development that it seems to be eating up our valley, doesn't it?
Well, unfortunately, you know, and we've, I think, gone past our carrying capacity. And sure, I know a lot of people would like to move up here and live here, and I did. I wouldn't blame them. I arrived here kind of intermittently over the years, but settled here 25 years ago. And people need a place to live. On the other hand, the landscape can only hold so many humans. And years ago, we did a little study on, you know, how many people could the Roaring Fork watershed support with food that came off the land itself? And we had to make some assumptions about what people would eat. And we assumed, well, let's say they're going to eat plenty of beef and potatoes, which are two things you can grow well here. We concluded you could have about 12,000 year-round residents. And here we are, we're up around 50,000 or something like that. Yep. And I think that's about, you know, that's where you draw the line, because these food producing systems are also the systems that are producing clean air and clean water and wildlife. And if you saturate the landscape with humans, it becomes unhealthy.
And they don't have anywhere to go.
Right.
Especially if you build across their migratory routes that they've had for thousands of years.
Sure.
And yeah, there's not much consideration there.
Sure. So, you know, the global population problem is another matter, and that obviously has to be dealt with, and humans need to get into a kind of an equilibrium with the biosphere that they're living on. But
for sure,
I think land conservation is a big piece of that.
What motivates you? What inspired you? Where did you get your love for the land?
That's a great question. And I'm going to have to credit high school or junior high school science teacher in starting that journey. You know, I was just grew up in Southeast Denver and, you know, typical rowdy kid. I was out playing on my mini bikes and all this kind of stuff. But I had several educators who started talking about environmental ethics. But then something happened to me that really catalyzed the whole thing. And this is a pretty personal story, but I was riding my bicycle over the top of Mount Tamalpais. And I was coming down the other side of Mount Tam. I did about 70 miles that day. I was kind of a gung-ho cyclist in those years. And coming down the other side of Mount Tamalpais, I looked up, and here comes a motorcycle that's cutting the corner, and he's on my side of the road. And I, just about the time my brain told me he's going to hit you, the whole landscape turned white. And I left. Wow. I wasn't there when the impact happened.
Wow.
And when the dust settled, I came back into my body, and I'm sitting there on my butt on the pavement with little pieces of this bicycle I was on scattered all over the place. It literally exploded out from under me. And I had some pretty good cuts, but I wasn't seriously injured.
Wow.
And in that moment, I changed. I was like, that there was a spirit in that landscape that helped me just now. And it came out, I felt it come right out of the ground. I mean, and I started reading a lot of Native American spiritual things, trying to figure out what had happened. But so I got fascinated in these cultures that had this deep relationship to the land. And I know you are well aware of those things, and that's one of the ways we got to be such close friends, is because of your relationship with the Ute and others. But after that, I went back to school, and my political science degree at Santa Cruz. I did my thesis on sacred sites on public lands that were Native American spiritual sites, and eventually went to law school, worked on some Supreme Court briefs on that same issue. So although I believe in saving land because of its ecological values and its aesthetic values, I also think there's a spiritual side to it. And it's probably the side that pulled me in to make this my career.
Well, you mentioned earlier about listening, and when you're dealing with human beings, and life is really about two things, relationships and timing. But that listening part is, I think we've left the land so long ago, left it in the sense of not living on it, not really connecting that much with it. But there's, I think, inside us that desire to do that. And I think if we listen, that's what got me started on the journey with the Utes, was listening to the land and just asked me a question. It wasn't like Moses and the burning bush, but it asked, where are the people who belong here? And that took me off on a whole different direction, just like you're talking about, right, where the land became important and the people on that land who had that connection became important to reconnect them to together. And that's why I've loved land since I was a kid. But that crystallized it when the land spoke to me like that.
Well, so there it is. And yeah, that's why I always think that humans in their sense of their spirits are a critical piece of landscapes.
And it's like I once had a conversation about sacred sites with Terry Knight, the Ute Mountain Ute tribe. And he said, you can't make a site sacred. You can label it. I mean, we label cemeteries as National Register sites, important to our history because people died there in battles. But their dying there made that sacred, not you designating it as anything. And there is a presence in the land that I have felt myself that is it calls you. It calls you to, I think, to really do your part in trying to save it or trying to get it to, like you're doing, trying to make a difference in not having somebody just sell out to a developer when they can actually preserve the land. That's a calling as well.
Yep.
The land called you, didn't it?
It's a calling. Here I am, and I'm somehow figured out a way that I could do what I love most and get someone to pay me to do it. So
right.
I feel pretty blessed about that.
Well, we got a little time left. If you got a good story for us, you've seen a lot of things and dealt with a lot of people, and I'm sure you could be a humorous story or not, but dig back deep if you can and think about what you'd like to close with.
A good story. Wow. Well, maybe I'll say a little something about my late friend Tim McFlynn.
Okay.
Who, in terms of the Pitkin County Open Space Program, he's the guy that made that happen. And Tim had been a civil rights lawyer out in Southern California and moved to Aspen and got involved with land preservation concerns. It started with a public access case up Hunter Creek. Well, he helped win that case. Against the predictions of some of the pundits that were running around the time. But around that same time, he was contacted by our friend Connie Harvey, who was one of the ladies who had championed the designation of Maroon Belt's Wilderness. And Connie said, well, geez, Tim, we need a way to protect land in the Roaring Fork Valley. And relying on donations is not going to get us where we need to go. We need a funding source to do that. And I hear Boulder County and Boulder City both have these funding sources. We look into that and maybe we could do something like that up here. Well, Tim went to town on that suggestion and wrote the amendment to the county charter about the Pitkin County Open Space Program that I work for. And by this point now where we're sitting here talking about it, there's been about $500 million invested in this. And it all happened because Connie made that suggestion to Tim, and Tim hauled off and wrote the charter, and then sat through meetings with the county commissioners and convinced them it was going to work out, and empowered a board of trustees and so on. I guess that you know, that's a story about these slender threads of human motivation that start out small but lead to really important things happening.
So. And one person can make a difference still. He made a huge difference by following his dream and what he wanted to do. And I think that's probably the lesson to learn, is if you got a dream, get the people that you know can help you, and you'll meet people along the way that'll help you, and you'll do what you really want to do, instead of settling for a job or a profession or just a career when the meaning's not there, the heartfelt desire that you have to do something to make a difference.
Right, right.
So
Dave Brower used to like to quote Goethe, and the quote is, whatever you think you can do or dream you can, begin it, because boldness has genius and power in it.
All right. I like that. That's a good quote. I'd have to write it down. I couldn't remember it, so we'll have to do that after a while. You know, thanks a lot. We appreciate you being here, Dale, and tune in to For Land's Sake every Monday. Every second Monday of the month. Second Monday of the month, 4:30. Thank you. And whatever you do for Mother Nature, do it for land's sake.
Right. Thank you, Bill, and happy birthday.